lyrically, yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? You hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm Young H.O., rap's grateful dead.
Wherever you're listening in the world and whatever time it is, welcome to Miami Noise, a confessional, an increasingly a confessional about all the weird and wonderful and insanely, ridiculously talented people who have been drawn like moths to a flame, like Farrell to a Gong Li for this movie. I am one half of the partnership that is steering this unfathomably fast car around late night Miami streets, Blake Howard, and giving directions and talking angrily on her cell phone loudly into the air is my legendary partner, Katie Walsh.
Hello. I will not steer you wrong, my friend. I will not give you the wrong navigational directions.
Never. We just keep driving into the sunset. The legendary Bilge Ibiri wrote an amazing piece for Vulture, if you haven't already read it, about the incredible legacy of Michael Mann's Miami Vice. It again has been one of his films that has grown, you know, fans and people around the world are sort of increasingly grown fond of. It's often called like the most Michael Mann film of all time. And as a result of that article, so many incredible people reached out to us and just seemed to have some attention because Bilge gave us that sort of heroic shout out that he did on the show. And one of the shout outs was an extremely talented filmmaker who I've since learned doing a bit of research was actually an MTVU student filmmaker at 2006, which I think if you're seeing Miami Vice in 2006 as a student filmmaker, maybe is like the greatest formative experience of his life. I mean, so we have another talented writer, director, producer working across a whole stack of films whose latest film, in fact, has, I think not one, not two, but maybe in the behind the scenes, like three or four Michael Mann all-stars that have been around and is just a huge fan of this film and was dying to talk to us really about saying goodbye, one of the great endings in Michael Mann's entire oeuvre. So it's our pleasure to welcome, and I can tell you in a test and a screenshot is coming to our socials that he is actually nursing a mojito, Josh Caldwell. Welcome to Miami Nice.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. And you left out the one thing that makes that timeline in Miami Vice so great is that he says, I don't remember the exact time, we'll say it's 11:27. He says 11:27 o'clock. Like that's like the best. It's not at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, at 11:27 on a Saturday night. It's 11:27 o'clock. Like it's one of those things, right? Especially when I remember seeing that in the theater, I was like, that is a weird way to say that time.
Well, maybe it's the Irish bleeding through. We forget that Colin Farrell wasn't there. Colin Farrell wasn't there.
Right.
It's unequivocal at this point. But yeah, so, I mean, please tell us about, you're already a student filmmaker in 2006. So I imagine you're seeing this movie out there. You're working in MTV. You're working in student films. Obviously, digital filmmaking now being democratized at that time. Like, tell us right from the get-go, how important was that experience for you in the cinema? Because I think it, I mean, besides that line reading, it feels like something that was formative for you, Josh.
Well, here's the funny part. Just to back up a beat, and you talk about this being a confessional, I'll throw out an amazing confessional that I think few people have. So, you know, I came of age, movie age, so to speak, in like the 90s, right? Like seeing all these fantastic filmmakers getting to make studio level films with huge budgets, but with really unique visions. You had Ridley Scott, you had Michael Mann, you had Soderbergh, you had Clint Eastwood, you had, you know, just David Fincher, just these insane, you know, even Michael Bay doing The Rock and like, you know, just these really, really awesome movies that were being made at a time when there was no franchise. And so I started seeing movies, you know, I kind of came of age and I started saying, I want to learn more. And I started watching like Usual Suspects and Pulp Fiction and like all these movies that I hadn't seen yet. And I remember at one point I watched Heat. And at this point, like, you know, I'd watched all these great movies, you know, obviously like Reservoir Dogs, got very into Tarantino and all this stuff. And I watched Heat knowing nothing about Michael Mann. And I get to the end and I'm just blown away by sort of the epicness of this film. And up comes the title, directed by Michael Mann, written and directed by Michael Mann. And in my head I go, whoa, the guy that played Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs directed this movie? And obviously thinking of Michael Madsen, but like, yeah. It just in my brain didn't, because I didn't know, you know, I conflated it, but for like definitely more than a day.
That's amazing.
I assume that the guy that played, you know, Michael Madsen actually directed this amazing epic story. And I'm like, why is he acting? Like, he should just keep making movies like
he
that.
Should never act again. I mean, Mr. Blonde
never
is
act
good.
Again. Just keep writing these crime epics, you know?
Didn't know he had it in him, Michael Madsen.
Exactly. So that's my, like, embarrassing story about it. But, and then obviously after I came to understand it, like, I remember seeing, you know, Ali in the theater on Christmas Day. We went with my family. And then seeing Collateral, you know, and stuff like that. And then going back and watching The Insider, which if you guys ever do a podcast on The Insider, like, please tell me, it's my favorite movie of all time. Like, I love that movie to death.
Listen, Josh, we'll have to talk offline about a potential bonus, All the President's Minutes. But I think what was great about that show, All the President's Minutes, not only talking about Pakula, who's one of our guys, but I think that show has so many insider digressions. I think it's
I'm sure.
I mean, The Insider is just, I mean, it's a special movie. It's really insane.
Oh, it's, I mean, it's just like it to me. That's the most, in some ways, the most Mann film. But anyway, coming back to Miami Vice, so primed at this age, seeing all these movies, coming off of Collateral, which, like, to me was such a great blend of sort of Michael Mann's aesthetic with a very commercial, sort of fairly straightforward narrative. You know, you just start hearing about Miami Vice and you're like, this is going to be the shit. Like, I can't wait. And I remember seeing it in the theater and I remember hating it. Like, really just being like, what the fuck was that? Like, you know, and just kind of leaving like severely disappointed in what I had just watched, which I don't think is an uncommon reaction, obviously. And you know, and part of what I reached out, what I was so curious to talk about, because I haven't yet heard it talked about, is that I think that if you walk into a Michael Mann film expecting it to be framed through the lens of a commercial style action movie, you will always be disappointed.
Yes.
Because that's not the filmmaker he is. And if you instead view it through the lens of, and I'll front everything I say after this with, like, I don't know Michael personally. I've never had this conversation with him. This is all just conjecture and guessing, but that he is at heart an expressionist experimental filmmaker. He Absolutely, just has a lot of money on which, in a giant canvas on which he can play. And when you reframe your thinking through that, his movies open up to you and become instantly, you know, rewatchable, and you can create numerous podcasts about it, you know, and sometimes it's like, you know, and I think that was my problem with it. I went in, and like a lot of people did, thinking this is going to be a big budget shoot 'em up, you know, kind of thing. And it wasn't. And as a result, especially for somebody in, like, you know, whatever, they're 20 years old or 22 years old, you're not getting it, you know? And then, but the funny part is all the things that you dislike, and I think I've heard a guest say this, all the things that on the first watch you dislike, those end up being all the things that you end up liking
totally.
When you come back to watch the movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was my initial thing, was just to say, was just seeing it in the theater and just hating it and sort of now wishing, well, I wish I had seen it differently. But over the years, rewatching it and just continually rewatching his whole canon of movies, I've come to appreciate, because he's just, what makes him special is he's a big budget sort of action thriller type director that directs those movies unlike anybody else, you know. Yeah. So often action movies are like you don't really know who the director is, you know, and or you can, it's, you're unable to really discern, you know, the aesthetic of it. But when you look at a Michael Mann film, you just instantly know it's a Michael Mann film.
Totally. And I appreciate you saying that he is he's an expressionistic experimental filmmaker, but he's applying that approach to what we think of as like these typical genre movies, like a heist movie, an undercover cop movie, an investigative whistleblower movie where you expect it to be this genre piece, but then it turns into this like really existential, often dread-filled or like very ruminating kind of bleak ending film, even though and it's also like suffused with romance. But I do think that there's like this weird chemical thing that he's doing where it's like the genre plus the aesthetic approach plus the philosophical approach, and that's what makes the Michael Mann movie.
Yeah, it's a hanger on which he can put all these other clothes, you know, genres. And even with the biopics, right? Even with the ones that are based on true stories, like it's not, I mean, in every filmmaker, when you're doing a true story, you've got to make creative changes. But he, I think, even views the true stories as just a hanger on which he can explore the sort of psychodrama and the deeper subjectiveness of for the most part, these men and their stories and how they do what they do. I mean, obviously he's very into sort of men and the professions that they, you know, pursue. And he, you know, again, as a filmmaker, you have, certainly as a filmmaker at his level, you have the choice on the story of which stories you want to do. And so obviously he's drawn to very specific ones. And I think that, you know, what's been interesting to me is that I also think that that Miami Vice was such a turning point in the work that he was doing too. And it's certainly an aesthetic turning point built off of Collateral in some way, but that kind of with Miami Vice, he really started leaving sort of a lot of the formalism of his previous work behind, partly because he was no longer shooting on 35, which even with a ton of money still contains limitations. But also, you know, you can see then that progression happen in Black Hat, which to me is probably most expressionistic film and probably why most people really dislike it. You know, but Miami Vice became to me that turning point where he went full like, oh, I'm gonna really push so much of this stuff to the limit and just see how far I can take people with me. And whether that's a conscious choice or not, I'm not really sure. But, you know, I think like if you look back at his time when, you know, which is hard to do because he's buried all these movies, but like from the little you know about his time at the London Film School, so much of that was built on that much more expressionistic experimental film work. And yeah,
He's buried those films, or he's buried them inside one cutaway in Ali to actually, you know, like there's a documentary playing and it's on the screen for 10 seconds. And that was a Michael Mann joint, you know?
Right. He's like, I'll use that.
Yeah, I'll use that.
I'll take that license fee. But yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, and he admits, like he said that he, as a young student filmmaker, you should feel free to make 2-minute, you know, movies about a leaf or, you know, something blowing in the wind and then bury it so that nobody ever sees it. I'm sure that's what he did. But to me, I think that, you know, I mean, again, the movie he credits for having him become interested in film is Dr. Strangelove. Like, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a numerous other films. It's a very quirky, you know, I mean, comedy of all things, but
There's one thing about Dr. Strangelove that I want to mention to folks, which I love, and I'm so glad you brought it up, Josh, because I rarely get to talk about it, but it's just something that came up in my research about it. So Dr. Strangelove, the one major thing that I think is so Michael Mann about Dr. Strangelove is Kubrick asked the American Air Force if he was allowed to film inside a bomber. And they said no. And he goes, okay, well, can I just send a photographer there? And they said, yes. And so he had one of his photographers come in and just take snaps. And then his set builders button for button reassembled a nuclear bomber cockpit. Right? For Strangelove. That's what you see in the film.
Right.
So much so that military investigators went to him and said, where did you get this? Because like, they're like, we thought you were going to take a snap and like partially recreate it. He literally created the actual inside of an American nuclear bomber.
They're like, this is the actual thing.
Nationals are going to like infiltrate our intel.
We don't know what spies can see, but everyone can see Dr. Effing Strangelove, you jerk.
Yeah, right.
So I love the dichotomy of those two things. Like, one, having you know, having actors like hammered up to a variety of degrees, play multiple characters, like all the insanity of that movie. And yet couched in it is probably the most hyper-specific and hyper-realistic portrayal of
That's Michael Mann too. Yeah, like I recreated this mural I saw in Paraguay, like, you know,
I loved it in this location. We put it here instead.
Like, right. But like, no one's going to be like, that's a really authentic mural, it's important to him.
Important to Kubrick. You got put in the shots in the cockpit are so minute, really. Like, I mean, you get to see James Earl Jones, who's in the movie, plays the pilot in Strangelove. And so you get to see him and he's distracting because it's James Earl Jones. Right. You're like, oh, it's James Earl Jones. Oh, this is cool. Wonder how big a role he's going to play. But yeah, so I think that's what's so funny about Mann is that ability. And like you said, I just think it's so underrated. It's so underrated, great genre filmmaking. It's so deeply dismissed. And in Australia, we have a thing called what we call cultural cringe. And it just so happens that some of our deeply admired and revered film critics, particularly David Stratton, who is like, he had a movie show of the equivalent in Australia of like the Siskel and Ebert sort of shows. So he hates like cultural cringe stuff, hates genre filmmaking. And in our country, it just gets pushed to the side, but I'm like, every one of Michael Mann's movies is a genre movie, technically, right? And every one of Kubrick's movies is a genre movie. But no one's ever calling them the genre movie because they're just loaded with so much everything. Like they're overwhelming.
Yeah. And I think especially with Strangelove, you know, versus a lot of other movies that were coming out at the time, I think probably part of that response was, oh, you can do that? You can make a movie like that?
Right.
You know, oh, well, now it's open to us. I mean, coming out of like so much of the sort of tight formalism of the studio movies being made, I mean, in the same way that now today we're seeing that fatigue with like the superhero movies where it's utterly predictable. A lot of people enjoy it, nothing against them, but like there's so many movies today, and look, I made them too, like where you see the trailer, like I know exactly what that movie is. Like I don't even need to see it. I know exactly what it is. And I think like, you know, what's been interesting is like with Michael Mann, in a good way or a bad way, everybody then sees the movie, you're like, that is not what I thought the trailer was going to be on the trailer. Yeah.
I do wonder, like, you know, we've talked about these sort of phases of his career, and I wonder if like Collateral/Miami Vice is sort of like the beginning of like, I don't know, would you call it like phase three of his career, where he's like kind of embracing the digital, going for more expressionistic stuff and like kind of pushing that digital filmmaking and storytelling and like that, those sort of themes. They all those films seem to be like, of, you know, kind of talking to each other, or at least in relationship to each other.
Yeah, it's a real trend. There's a real transition phase. I think The Insider The Insider feels like a punctuation. Like it feels like a punctuation mark, because it's like Heat is the ultimate zenith of everything that he's been trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Philosophically and visually, and like Josh mentioned earlier, just like his more rigid classical formalism. And then The Insider, I mean, he just contrast the two opening shots of the Insider and Heat. Heat is this beautiful glacial composition of a train in Los Angeles, such a rare thing at the time, at night, creeping into a station, bringing you the main character. The Insider is a POV shot from inside a Hessian sack on your head.
Yeah, like the blindfold.
Yeah, it's the blindfold looking out with like little flecks of light coming through the thatch of the material, and then this overwhelming like car sounds bouncing around the road, this incredible Mid-Eastern music that's playing.
There's just an immediacy there that, yeah, I mean, Heat is this epic, but Heat is so controlled even when it's not controlled. There's one shot that foreshadows all this in Heat, which is the scene where he goes to, I'm forgetting on his buddy's name. Who owns the taco joint? Why can't I think of his name right now? Trejo. Yeah, Trejo's.
In real life, he owns the tacos. Yeah,
no, I was like, oh, the taco stand now.
I'm like, which, come on, what? You know, he owns it. I'm trying to think of the
Trejo's
name.
Trejo's Tacos.
Trejo's Tacos, got you.
And De Niro's in the house, and is shot with this really erratic handheld, like on a wide lens, really erratic, like moving through the house. It's the only time in that movie that he really does that. And so, but the rest of the movie is so composed. And then contrast that with The Insider, which was the next thing, as just way more handheld, like much more tight close-ups, very few wides, like everything gets, it's like flipped. Yeah. And I'd be curious, like if I ever sat down with him and had a chance to interview him, I'd say like, what happened between Heat and The Insider? Like, where did this switch? Like, what caused this sort of switch in your approach aesthetically? I mean, I'm like so fascinated with Michael Mann's aesthetic because it's so unique. And part of me has been trying to figure out like how to do it, like not do him, but like how he does it. Right. And I think like one of the things about digital, you know, especially is that, you know, even with Miami Vice, like he was still shooting with some fairly large cameras, you know? Yeah. And once he got into like Black Hat and Luck and those movies where he started shooting stuff on the 5D, where, you know, you're just, I mean, just like Soderbergh, right? Like becoming his own DP, like just using, like, I know so many DPs are like, man, those movies look like shit. They look terrible. I'm like, yeah, but like they are 100% him, you know, or 100% man. Like,
I mean, Soderbergh's
cameras and mixing it, like it's so crazy. Like, and I think the fact that, like, what's interesting is with Mann, he has all the money in the world. He does. It's not a compromise, and yet he's deliberately making these choices to shoot things on digital for these purposes, and taking advantage of their imperfections and taking advantage of what they do. That it's really, you know, it's just interesting because he does have the money, you know, and he has the time, like, to do it, you know, and that brings me to something else. But go ahead, and you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to quickly say with Soderbergh, he's just like a drastic overachiever. Like he may as well cater his own films. He edits them, he shoots right. them, he directs them. Often, sometimes he contributes to the writing. It's just unbelievable. Like he's not a unique human being in that. Oh, sorry, he's a completely unique human being in that regard. Other than, you know, other filmmakers, he's just, you know, he went and shot and edited Magic Mike Double XL because he didn't want to direct. And I'm like, you're right. holding the camera right. for every shot. Like,
yeah,
you know, like it's, I mean,
might as well direct.
Might as well.
I don't want to talk to the actors anymore.
That's a very George Lucas thing. But no, I was just going to say, yeah, I think that point, those points of The Insider, and this, it's funny. I wanted to talk about this one with Katie is there's actually two crazy small handheld video cameras that get used in Heat in a matching shot that it's sort of hard to pick up. And we picked it up in One Heat Minute, which was that shot where
it's in the hotel.
Yeah, well, in the hotel, but he grabbed, there's the other shot, which Katie will love, which is where Al Pacino is allegedly grabbing Henry Rollins. And throwing him out a window.
Oh, yes, so that's
this
right.
This tiny fraction of a second of like him grabbing his face and then the reverse angle shot,
like a little lipstick cam or something at that time. Yeah.
Tiny lipstick cam. And then the next one is exactly right. Josh is in the hotel with Wayne Grow. And you can just see, like, after scrutinizing the living daylights out of that movie, obviously you start to see those bits and you're like, oh, he was thinking about some of these things. And then The Insider, he gave himself license to just do everything that he wanted, like that he had aspired to do. And then when you get past The Insider and you go to Ali, his very conception of the way that he would compose, like, a, you know, the central, you know, storytelling device of the movie, which is all these different fights that map out and mirror parts of, you know, how his life's going down. They're all in these hyper crazy, you know, handheld versions, like where literally there's such great photos of like Michael Mann holding a camera in over Will Smith's shoulder while he's punching
a
guy, like
a lipstick cam.
He's doing that. So yeah, it's so weird to know whether it's like instinct or intuition or it's something that he's seen before that's influenced him. But I feel so much that like he's such a guy who's about what is practical and what makes sense. And what is going to underscore the themes that I'm delivering, that I feel like it's
exactly,
I feel like it's just all like, we've got to shoot it like this. And that's the only choice.
And I respect that so much of choosing the style and the aesthetic and the camera to tell the story that you want to tell. And I think that, you know, we've said this many times on this podcast, but like, that's what makes it work so well in Miami Vice.
Yeah.
And the choices, the aesthetic choices that he makes to tell that specific story. So
I think if he, and this comes back to the subjectivity that he approaches every movie with, right? Like, I feel like if he could put a camera into a character's head through their and shoot through their eyes, he would do it. Like, I constantly feel like he's trying to get as inside and close up as he can. And he uses there's a camera device called the PS Technic Skaterscope, which I used on Infamous. And what it does is it's this weird long sort of thing that used to shoot miniatures. Like, you use it if you want to shoot in a dollhouse, right? And you attach it to the camera, and then you you basically attach the lens on the other end. And what it does is it allows you, the effect that it has is it allows you to actually shoot super, super close to your subject and keep them in focus. And so it's sort of like a diopter. I don't know why he wouldn't use a diopter, but he uses this device. He used it on, I mean, so much so that on Luck, each camera team carried one with them, like on the shoot. And you can tell, like, for example, the shot in Miami Vice, where they're in the trailer and they've just gotten in, you know, before they kill the guy with the detonator. And there's that shot on Jamie Foxx, and it's like framed like right that's the PS Technic.
Oh my God. Those close-ups, sorry to interrupt you. Those close-ups are like, so this period of man to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those hyper, hyper close-ups. Like, every time I see it, I'm like, yep, there it is again.
It's a very unique close-up. And it's when he does the over the ear stuff, and it's like, how can I get this camera as close to the actor's face as possible without it being literally touching them? And it's this aesthetic that, again, like, I wanted to try and use it because I wanted to see what it would do. But again, looking for, I'm as a filmmaker, I love the subjective approach to things. Probably why I love Michael Mann so much, but like, I love to try and do it in my own work. And so I was like, I want to use this to my DP. And she like reached out, and she came back. She's like, everyone I talked to her, like, he wants to use this for what? Like, why does he want to use this thing? And I'm like, let's just get it. I kept trying on every movie to get it. Finally I did on Infamous. And it was just like, it does. It just creates this really odd effect that allows you to shoot very, very tight close-ups and get very close to your subject in ways that regular, right? Like, it decreases the minimum focus on your lenses, and it just creates such a unique look. And a lot of, again, people don't necessarily like pick up on it as you're watching it, but all this stuff that Michael does in the movies does hit the audience, whether they're aware of it or not.
Yeah.
It is hitting the audience in some way. And I think that's also what he's always attempting to do, is find a way to psychologically affect the audience as they're watching the films, whether they're aware of that or not.
Yeah, it creates the overall effect of whether it's like that it's like weirdness or something. Like, you mentioned the like 11:17 o'clock. Like, it's just a little bit weird. It doesn't sound right. Those close-ups are a little too close. Like, it's all a sense of, yeah, it's a subjective sense of weirdness or you know, trying to get into the interiority of Jamie Foxx in that moment as he's like making the decisions of what he's going to do.
Right. And it's just so not a part of traditional filmmaking approach. And, you know, another great example of that is in the scene that you guys talked about before on another podcast, where they're on the freeway and they pull over and they have, you know, John Hawks' character, and they're like talking to him. And there's that shot right before he walks in front of the truck. It starts on Colin and it drifts to Jamie, and then the focus drifts off to the background, right? And it's a very subjective, it's almost a POV shot. And it's just this odd effect. And you could just see what you're doing is he's going, we're going to give the audience the effect of this guy's mind just drifting into death, you know? And it's just going to drift off as he realizes that he's got nothing left. And then he's going to step into the truck, you know? Only Michael is really attempting that kind of subjectivity in an action film.
Yeah.
You know, to me, one of the most haunting images I've ever seen in a film is in Black Hat, where they're in the middle of a shootout. And, you know, I'm so bad with names. I'm trying to remember exactly what her name, which actress it was.
Viola Davis.
Viola Davis. And And I only forget names when I'm on podcasts, by the way. when she gets shot in the shootout and she's laying on the ground and the camera's over her as her eyes start to drift. And then it cuts to that shot of the skyscraper as it fades. And it doesn't fade all the way out. It just fades just enough. You're like, whoa, holy shit. Like, that was basically the perspective of someone dying.
Yeah.
And what they last saw. And that, like, freaked me out for a little bit. And you don't expect that from a movie like that, right? You just, oh, she gets blown away. And
right.
On the floor and you're done. Like, but
no, he, like, takes a moment to, like, make us share in that.
Yes.
Yeah, it takes a moment in the middle of the shootout to show the perspective of death encroaching on somebody. You're just like, whoa. Wild. And in the middle of a movie like that, a thriller, like, and I think that's what makes these movies of his so insanely rewatchable, you know.
And
in a way, you know, and with Miami Vice, I think that's to bring it back to that, because we talked about a lot of the other movies.
You don't have to worry about the digressions, we've got you.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it is that nature of it. It's when Colin Farrell's, you know, up on that bout, you know, up in the apartment of Nicholas's place, and he drifts off and he's looking at the view out the window of the ocean. It's like these little moments that just open it up in terms of it not being this straightforward action film.
So, Josh, I'm dying to know, I'm kind of changing the subject here a little bit, but your newest film, Mending the Line.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Has Brian Cox and Wes Studi. So when you were shooting, were you like dying to just be like, tell me about Michael Mann, talk to me about Manhunter?
I really,
or were you holding yourself back, or were you like, just like getting into it?
I didn't want to be too much like, I only hired you because you worked with Michael Mann. And, I don't care if we finish the movie. I just need you to tell me about your experience.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it definitely was a little bit, I mean, you know, certainly it's not really why, you know, but I think like,
I mean, Brian Cox is great.
Brian Cox, amazing. Wes Studi, their unfathomable talent literally speaks for itself. Like, you just like, if you said I was hiring those guys at any other time, but if you're a Michael Mann geek and you've got the option to hire those guys, it's like, oh, I'm hiring those guys. Are you kidding?
Oh yeah. I mean,
which we'll
come back to, but I did in 2015, I directed a series that was on Hulu for a little bit, and it's not very good, but it was set in Miami and we shot in Miami. And so I got to spend like basically 6 months in Miami, and there's a bunch of stuff I went and did there. But one of the guys, I remember one of the actors in it, I was looking at a couple different options, and this guy, he had played the air traffic controller in Miami Vice.
Yeah.
That guy, we're hiring that guy.
Like, you're like, of all the guys, just that one.
Okay, there's three guys are equal. Well, this guy was in a Michael Mann film, so we're gonna hire him.
Amazing.
And I asked him about it. I was like, so you were in Miami Vice? He's like, yeah, dude. He was like, it was awesome. And I said, well, what was it like? He was like, it was crazy. He's like, you know, we set it up. He's like, the scene in the movie is like 3 seconds long. It's not very long, but he's like, they shot there for like at least half a day. And he said, what he did was they set it all up. He's like, Michael came in, he got some shots. And then he basically said to the camera guy, who's like, all right, hose it down. And then he left. And the camera guy just like shot, you know, reams of material of this really short scene, you know, and that was his experience. He was like, yeah, we shot, Michael was there for a beat. He kind of like did a couple things. And then he said, all right, just keep shooting and hose it down. You know, obviously that scene doesn't have Jamie or Colin in it. So he was on to other stuff, but yeah, no, I mean, if you can, why not? You know, I'm really fortunate to work with this guy, Eros Hoagland, who's stills photographer now, but he was a photojournalist. And I got to know him because I watched this series on HBO called Witness, which was exec produced by Michael Mann. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a fantastic documentary series about photojournalists, like various ones. And like Eros was down in, he was down in Mexico, and Juarez, and he was in, where'd he go? He went further down into, I'm trying to remember exactly where he went, but, and then the Congo. And it's just, I mean, it's beautiful. It was all shot on 5Ds. And I think Michael came in like after it was made and kind of signed, you know, came on board to produce it. But as a result, Eros got to, he did all the stills on Black Hat. And then he also just shot all the stills on the pilot episode of Tokyo Vice that Michael's doing.
Yes.
And so I got to work with him and brought him on, and I got connected with him because I was just a fan of his work, and we were going to work on another project. And, you know, he's always telling me stories about Mike, and really you got to talk to those guys. I don't want to speak for them, but I mean, with Brian and Wes, you know, it was a challenge to not make it feel like all I wanted to do was talk about Michael, but at the same time, like, that's all I wanted to do. I was like, just tell me stories. You know, Wes had, you know, again, they should be the ones, and I'm happy to connect you guys with him, but like he was telling us, like,
Katie's like, I'm like, typical.
The nicest guy, by the way. He's really, both of them are sweethearts. And you know, Wes told me that they would finish, you know, they were doing the shootout. He told me about the shootout stuff. He's like, they would, at the end of the day or at the end of every take, they'd be sweeping up all the brass from all the blanks. And he's like, they would be in piles, like 3-4 feet high on the streets of downtown LA as we just unloaded all of these weapons. But, you know, I didn't get any Last of the Mohican stories, but I mean, these guys, you know, they were great, and they it was just fun to be around them and work with them and sort of get a, you know, with Brian, it had been so long, like he hadn't worked with him again since Manhunter, but
so longer. And the funny thing with Brian Cox is, like, after everything he's done, there's still people going, hey, Manhunter. And he's like, really? Like, you can almost tell in some of the interviews you read with him. He's like, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And Michael was great, and it was so terrific. But like,
he's like, I did 4 days on.
Yeah. Like, I wasn't there for a long time.
And then he's like, yeah, there's another person who played Hannibal Lecter a little bit more memorably than me.
That other people seem to gravitate to too. But I think Brian's, again, if you're a man geek, it's just a different world, you know? And again, like I think that's what's really interesting too, because you've got what's really so distinct about Michael can be boiled down to Silence of the Lambs versus Manhunter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Same story. And effect, well, not same story, Red Dragon, I guess, you know, but like Red Dragon, the sort of commercial, typical Hollywood approach to that movie, you see it and it's obvious, right? And everything is sort of perfectly lit and everything is perfectly shot. And then you got Michael's movie where, it was a different time, and a different budget, but even if he had the same budget and the same time, he would have shot it completely differently, in a completely different way. And I think that's so distinct in his approach to these genre movies and these movies in particular, that he is just seeing things differently than everyone else.
It's finally time, Katie. It's finally time that someone on the show that's not me, just want to be clear, ladies and gentlemen listening, that's not me, brought up Red Dragon. And so it is now time for me to say definitively that movie is fucking garbage. They took Michael Mann's original script. They took Dante Spinotti. They had all the money in the world. And that movie has about as much style as a fucking cheeseburger. It is ghastly. Yeah, it's in the best actors in the whole world, maybe at the best part of their careers. And it's awful. Overwhelmingly, staggeringly awful. There's like 7 or 8 Oscar winners in that movie. And it's a bag of shit. There is more style in one frame of Manhunter than there is in that whole ghastly movie. This is Josh not talking. This is Blake talking, ladies and gentlemen. Just in case Josh needs to work with these people again. But I would happily tell anyone that is the depths. That's the Marianas Trench of everyone's career who decided that they were going to do that movie and dare try and what? Be better than Manhunter? Stop. Wake up to yourself. Now, Brian Fuller's terrific show, Hannibal, does approach some of the same content. and does it with, I feel like, a very manly and panache style. It's all about the aesthetic. So much of it about the tone and the mood. And I just think that when you strip away, like, and even for all of its flaws, Ridley Scott's Hannibal has so much goddamn style. Like Jonathan Demme, right, the most humanistic filmmaker of all time, the whole thing is about style. It's about the right style of these interactions. And I love, you know, if you watch, that's probably a great trilogy of films to watch. Manhunter, Michael Mann style, Jonathan Demme, one of the greatest humanistic filmmakers of all time. Just the empathy that bleeds through the lens is just insane. And then Ridley Scott, who's just got like swagger and style for days, all about this like Baroque kind of architecture and framing and lighting, all those things, you know, Hannibal Lecter as a universal movie monster. And then you've got Red Dragon and you may as well just wipe yourself with it and discard it.
Thank you for bringing that up so that Blake could have the
I just needed to just
that.
Say
and now you don't need to ever talk about it again.
It's
right?
done.
You just can get it out there.
It's done. But I appreciate you bringing it to this forum because you're right. You know, and this is when we, to pivot back to Miami Vice, we've talked about it a few times and it's just a good point to reiterate. It's like, you could give that script to 10 different action filmmakers and it would not look anything. It would not look anything like Michael Mann's movie. It just wouldn't even, and I'm sure there are other movies that are out there that kind of look and feel like it. And I remember an interview where Jamie Foxx was talking about, Katie, did you ever see, or Josh, that there's a like an action, twisty action thriller based in Las Vegas, I believe, called Sleeper. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah. I think it's called Sleeper still. But yes, I'm aware of what you're talking about.
I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah, well, take a Google while I vamp with Josh here. But he was making this action movie. And at the time, I think what Fox was seeing in the material was sort of some of those ingredients maybe that drew him to Miami Vice. You know, some of those different things like, oh, it's a cool, like, twisty story. There's some cool character actors. We've got some great people that are along. And when you watch Sleeper, it's just, there's just something that is restricting it. It just doesn't work. There's something about the alchemy of the way that it comes together, that the cogs don't click in, and it just kind of never finds what it's trying to do. And I remember Jamie Foxx like joking, kind of, you know, bit self-deprecating about it, going like, I thought it would be like another Miami Vice. Like, Miami Vice seems to have a following, but it just like, it didn't work. And he sort of like, you know, took it on the chin. And I'm just like, yeah, because sometimes sometimes on paper, it can sound like a thing, but that great filmmaker with that great style who's going to bring something extra, it's just not there.
It's called Sleepless.
Sleepless.
No, that's okay.
I think too that, you know, I mean, the thing about Mann as well is that he's been fortunate in his success to be able to create the ways in which he makes movies, right? Which usually entails enormous amounts of research, enormous amounts of prep. You know, I mean, you look at, you know, one of the things they talk about on the Miami Vice thing is how when they were scouting, they carried around a fully built 35 millimeter camera package and an HD camera package. Like when I go scout, I've got my iPhone. Right, like they did it on Black Hat too. They were talking about how they were out in the bay of Hong Kong with the Airy Alexa, like, you know, on the bow of a boat, and a huge wave came over and totally destroyed the camera. Like,
oh my
God. They're walking around like, oh, you watch those behind the scenes, and Mann is sitting on a bed shooting curtains flowing in the breeze on 35 millimeter film, and that's just scout footage. That's just, you know,
Get us the scout footage.
You know, the
release the scout cut.
Yeah, like he goes, I love this bedroom the bedroom furniture in this room, but let's bring it to the other house in, you know, 1,000 miles away.
I love that shit so much.
And how he combines things like that bathroom, the bathroom that Gong Li and Colin Farrell are in, the shower that they're in. That's not in the house that they're actually in for the rest of, you know, it's like he chooses these little things, but he just has the ability to live in this environment and really think about it for a long time. And then even on the day when he's shooting, he just has that time to get that. And I know this from my perspective is like, as a filmmaker, I mean, like Mending the Line or Infamous, which I did before this, I mean, we shot those in 23 days. Like, you know, that's nothing, you know, and on that kind of shoot where you're shooting a normal script, you just don't have that time to step back and say, let's try this. And not that you're just shooting a lot of footage, but that you're able to actively respond to what's being presented in front of you. And a lot of times directors, you know, without sort of getting into the naming movies or naming names, like you don't have that same kind of prep. You don't have that same kind of immersion that Michael gets on the movies he has. And I think that also leads to what's different, you know, with Ridley Scott and Soderbergh, it's volume. They're just like cranking them. Soderbergh knows what he likes. Ridley's like, we're going to set up 8 cameras and we're just going to shoot the scene and then we're going to move on.
Ridley Scott is just like, I'm so jealous because you guys are in the States and I know that Katie has seen the House of Gucci. Ridley Scott is just he's a baller. Like there's only one way. He's a baller. Like he is just. When you see when you see him hang out with like the Wu-Tang
biggest
clan,
movie in the world, give him a small drama. It doesn't matter.
I mean, the fact that he replaced Kevin Spacey with Christopher Plummer in like 10 days is insane. And then Christopher Plummer gets nominated for an Oscar. I mean,
it at his age. I mean,
I know. The fact that he has Last Duel and House of Gucci just like, I mean, they're not going to be in cinemas at the same time, but it's just insane. I mean, the man is wild, and he's doing it. He's still doing it well, which is amazing to see.
And then it's funny to me, just coming back to that idea of like he has that enormous prep and he has that time and he has all that. He can shoot as many takes as he wants, you know, and all that stuff. At the same time, it's really interesting to me when you see the final movie and you see like there's a lot of mistakes in his movies, like things that people would say, why, like that's an error, right? I'll give you a great example. In the scene in Black Hat where they're tossing the jail cell, there's a shot that looks like it's on the guards. And the camera operator's hands reaches in and moves the guard out of the way. Like, go back and watch it.
Okay.
Go back and watch it. You see, it's like the guy's on the bed, the operator's on the bed, the guards are in front of him pulling the mattress and you see the guy's hand reach in and move something out of the way. Like, and you're going, I know that's not the only take you have of that. Like, I guarantee it. So why is that in there? Like, why do you have that shot?
Maybe that accident, he was like, to your point, Josh, of like immersion and subjective perspective. It's like, I actually want to feel what it would be like for one of the guards to move out of the way of one of their peers. And he's like, does the shirt kind of match? Does it like kind of feel like I feel like they did. I love exactly what you've been talking about a lot, which is the ability to find the mistakes and the time. And I want to recommend, I know this is another random tangent. Sylvester Stallone is making Rocky, another recut of Rocky IV. You know, a lot of people have been talking about the robot mostly, but there's actually for free on his YouTube, an hour and a half documentary about him remaking Rocky IV. And so you've got this man in his 70s, really talking through the psychology of how insanely fast-paced, you know, the filmmaking was at the time, how many million feet of footage they went through for all of the fights, all those things. And you literally watch him, and as he's cutting it, you're like, God, all this stuff he's saying makes sense. Like, listen how wise Sylvester Stallone is as a filmmaker. Like, he's probably forgotten more about making movies than most other people have ever learned. And it's just like, it's totally a film school in a little capsule of him just like, see this cut, see that, this cut, see this shot, that's unforgiving. He goes, I would never let that shot fly now because it's so unforgiving. Because he's like, if you put it on this angle, it fakes the depth perception. If you put it right in front of their face and the shot misses, you see it. Nah, we're going to replace that. This should have had more air. We should have had more time. Oh, and then he saw a shot of himself in, you know, close up, and he's like, God, that's such a vain shot. Give me another shot. God, I was so vain back then. It's so great. But it's like exactly what you're talking about. It's like sometimes he's now getting to go back and make all these changes, give all this air, have all this nuance. But I just am blown away that big directors still allow for organic things to happen on their sets.
I honestly think the sign of a master filmmaker is if you can ignore the continuity errors. Like, there are so many continuity errors in Scorsese films, you know, famously in Goodfellas, where the cups keep moving around during the conversation at the table. And it's like, no, the thing is the feeling. The thing is the vibe. The thing is not the cups. Like I always say, like when I'm looking at a film and I'm like counting the continuity errors, that means the movie isn't that good because I'm not invested in what the script is saying, what the characters are doing and what the actors are doing. Like I can forgive any continuity error when I'm like emotionally invested, but when I'm not emotionally invested and I start doing that stuff, then you're like, something's going wrong here. And and Mann is like, I always say, like, his films, even though they are so effortful, like they're so planned and prepared and researched heavily and you know, scouted with 35 millimeter cameras, like the effect is an effortlessness when I am watching. And and just it like looks, nobody does it like him.
Like he's just capturing it.
Yes, yes.
And that's such a hard quality.
It's so hard. It's so hard. When you watch people, I mean, I'm a critic, so I've seen so many movies that just like do not work. And when you see something that worked, you're like, this guy's got it.
Yeah.
I mean, just
this young whippersnapper, Michael Mann, has got it.
To your point, on set, so often we're saying, oh, if anybody notices that, we've already lost them.
Totally.
Like they're not paying attention to the rest of the movie. So what can you do about it? You know, there's a, I mean, and then there's other little weird things he does too. Like in the scene with, where Colin Farrell and Gong Li are in the car, you know, having sex, like in the back of the SUV, he says, you know, hola chica. And then it cuts to a shot of her and she says, hola chico. That shot is basically a shot that then gets reversed. Again, like if you look at it, it's a very weird shot where he kind of bounces and zooms in and then it bounces and zooms out. The effect being, I know as an editor and as a director, I'm like, I'm trying to hold on that shot for more time. Right. I'm not ready to cut when that cuts. But like, he does that a lot. I think he does that in the pilot episode of that happens in the pilot episode of Miami Vice, the show. There's a weird shot and then it reverses back onto itself. As a way of creating more time, like, you know, and part of the thing that I want to talk about, or the, when we talk about what I could speak about, was the ending. There's this scene where, you know, Jamie Foxx like grabs her hand at the very end and it freeze frames for like a half a second. It freeze frames. And you're like, that's such a weird, like, why? It's so interesting. Like, man has all the time in the world to get what he needs to capture it. He does, you know, he sometimes does hundreds of takes, I've heard, you know, and he'll often do things where he'll just take 24 frame footage and he'll slow it down. So it looks really choppy. And you're like, yeah, but you could have shot that in slow motion. Like what? I'm so fascinated by the choices that get made by somebody that I sometimes have to do that because I have nothing else. I don't have that option. You know, I've got to go with it, but you do. And so there's got to be intention behind that, or there's got to be a sense of aesthetic choice or reasoning or thought behind that, that fascinates me and makes rewatching these movies so doable because it just constantly asks those questions of me as a viewer and I never get the answers. So it's again, like, it's like a magic trick. Once you know how the trick's done, like you lose interest, you know? And so that to me is, you know, it's so, it's weird. Like in Ali, there's a shot where he comes in to talk to his, you know, it's in the winter and he's running and he comes in and talks to his lawyer. And in one of the versions of the film, it's like sits down to into a two shot and you see on the right side of the frame, you full on see the camera map box, the operator's hands, like it cuts right into it. And then it cuts to that shot that was clearly being shot at the same time. Like, and you know, it's, you, as an editor, you're always looking to take that stuff out. And I highly doubt that it just slipped through. Like, I do not believe that
it was
as
just
a filmmaker,
like that.
Michael doesn't notice that stuff.
Unfortunately, it's the best take, you know, it's the best take and it's got to stay.
Right. Right. I mean, there's there's a mistake again. If I had to boil it down, if I had an elevator ride with Michael and I had one question to ask him, it would be this. There's the scene at the end of The Insider when Al Pacino is walking through the control room. Mm-hmm. It's like a Steadicam and they're walking with him and it hits something and then it keeps going. Like if you go back and rewatch that scene, it's not some nice smooth dolly. It's not like, you know, it's she's walking and it goes like that and it janks on something. And I want to ask him, like, what is the deal? Why is that in the movie? Like, it's, you clearly had other takes. You must have had other takes. And that, all it is Pacino walking through. He's not, it's not a performance. It's not anything else. It's just this little shot and it's a jank. And you're just like, there's got to be something to it because question, I know you have other choices.
The answer to that question will unlock everything that we've been talking about for the past like 10 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
that will explain everything.
I was just going
to say, you ask that question.
But before we just get onto the end, that's Josh showing himself to be in the line with the David Finchers of the world, because there's a, you know, he talks about in even like Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Kate Blanchett's in this shot with a baby who's meant to be baby Benjamin Button. And just very organically, the little baby who she's holding his hand looks up at her and gives her a little kiss. And that's the shot that's in the movie. And David Fincher's camera operator was so excited that they got that, that he was shaking his hand, thumbs up to Fincher, and the camera was shaking. And Fincher's like, stop fucking shaking the camera. Stop shaking the camera. And that's on the commentary track of that movie. And so that's why you have to buy that movie just for that commentary track, because it's so funny. And I'm just like, I imagine someone going like, for him, it's so important that you guys, they ended up digitally adjusting the camera shake or whatever. But like, you know, you've got a little bit more of the command of the digital. But I think it's funny that you just picked that up. Your eye is trained for that.
I think that Michael and where he's gone with his aesthetic, you know, but even going back to parts of like, you know, Last of the Mohicans, where he started really kind of playing with more handheld and playing with a unique approach to the work was, I think he's my take is that he's fascinated by imperfection. As much as he's like constantly in search of accuracy and truth and, you know, perfection, like when he's telling him, you got to hold the hand like that as he's cutting through with the knife. Like, you know, he's got that very specific thing. There's also such an element of imperfection in his movies, in the way that it's shot, in the performances and the unpredictability of it. That is, I think, also what makes it exciting to watch, is like, they're not perfect movies in the stylistic sense. There's a lot of mistakes in them, you know, there's a lot of errors in them. There's a lot of imperfections in that camera work and the way it would move there. You know, there's shots in Miami Vice where they're on John Ortiz and all of a sudden it just shifts and there's no reason for the shift. There's no reason for that. You know, he has these way of doing these zooms. Like, he never dollies it. Like, you'll never see a dolly or rarely see a dolly, a push in, a push in dolly move in a Michael Mann film. He'll track stuff. But now what he does and what he's done or what he's been doing a lot of is he does a zoom, and he does these very imprecise zooms. It's not on a controlled dial or anything like that. It almost looks like somebody's, you know, janking it themselves. And I've started playing with that in my own work, but like, that's what he'll do to push in. And so you'll see that it's a quality to it that he's after, you know, that's really unique. And just to bring that around, because I know we never even got to it, but the idea of like the ending of Miami Vice, right? Like the finale of it, like, I think the reason why I wanted to talk about it or why I brought it up was to me, it contains three distinct elements that make Miami Vice so interesting and different and rewatchable, but also make them distinctly Michael Mann films. And that is, one, the safe house that they go to, you know, at the end when he sends her off. So I went down and found where it was when I was in Miami.
This is a confessional.
I gotta go see it. And it's down in it's on down in Sugarloaf Key, in the Keys. And I can tell you that location is, you can look it up. It's called Sammy Creek Landing.
Just give us the address and
we're
filming the show next week.
But if you look up Sammy Creek Landing, that's where they shot that. And the house that was there has since been torn down and it's been turned into a boat ramp or a boat launch or whatever. But it's down in like Sugarloaf.
Mm.
You see the bridge. The bridge is right there.
Mm-hmm.
Sugarloaf Key. That is nowhere near anywhere else that they shot Miami Vice. Like, it is a 3-hour drive to get down to that location. So to me, that idea that man is, I mean, I get going to Uruguay. I get, you know, going to Ciudad del Este. I get going to Haiti, whatever. Like, you're shooting blocks of scenes there. But let's go down to, let's take 3 hours to drive, to get down to this out of the way location that is nowhere near anything else, and then shoot this scene is one, a distinctly Michael Mann choice, right? I think to like set that there and do that there when there are numerous other closer locations that would have worked. The other thing is in the scene with Jamie Foxx in the hospital at the end, the freeze frame on the hand, such an interesting, unique way of using editing to like just freeze that moment in time, right? Like to freeze, to fuse them together in a way that just holds on it. But an odd choice to reflect that, right? He could have said, okay, just freeze, grip your hand and just hold it there for a second, hold it for a beat, right? I think is really interesting. And then the end, which is, you know, Colin Farrell walking, you know, the camera, again, using this zoom. It's got this janky zoom in move. They pick him up. They go past this massive white trailer that I guarantee you any DP would have said, why is this huge truck there? Probably a camera truck. I guarantee you that's a production truck, because why is there a massive semi at a hospital? I don't know. And it looks just like a production truck, and there's a giant white semi trailer.
I'm loving this.
and it pushes in and it cuts before he gets into the door.
Yeah.
Like, why does it cut? Like that's like, again, you think of these ending scenes, you think of Last of the Mohicans standing over the ridge, right? Like as the music plays, you think of the end of Heat, like De Niro and Pacino locked in a handhold with this beautiful tableau framed around him. You know, even like, you know, you look at Ali, he's got his hands up, like as he's framed in the rain and the black, right? And then you go to like Miami Vice and it's a shot of Colin Farrell from a distance with a giant semi trailer in it, walking into this tiny little lit doorway, and he doesn't even get into it. Like, again, I just think I'm so like endlessly this idea. I think one, the idea that he's going back to him, but that he never gets to his buddies again. I don't know what to make of it, but it, to me, it's such a choice that I don't see any other director making. You know, and those little three elements in the finale of this movie all add up to me as just such a distinct representation of Michael Mann's work and his aesthetic and how he approaches films, and the fact that he's trying to do more than just tell the story. You know, he's trying to really cement the audience in that perspective, but there's such a weirdness to it that,
yeah,
you know, it just makes you want to rewatch it because you're like, I'm missing something. Something
yeah, not,
I'm missing an element that is below the surface that I can't quite get. And I got to keep watching it because at some point I'll crack it.
Oh my God.
And so those to me, and not to mention the other one quick thing, I don't want to take too much of the time, but the other thing that, has anybody talked about the lightning?
Yeah,
we've sort of like touched on like the fact that it was a hurricane.
It's a hurricane,
but there are so many scenes with shots where the lightning is going off. I mean, there's Nicholas in his condo, yeah, and right as he hangs up the phone, lightning goes off. There's them standing on the parking lot. Meanwhile, does not track. Boom.
Lightning.
Like lightning goes off. Like Colin Farrell at the trunk answering the call from, you know, John Ortiz. Like, you know, lightning goes off. Like I get that they were shooting during hurricane season, but to have captured some of that perfectly, yes, timed.
Do you imagine how many takes? I mean, imagine how many takes.
They're just waiting. They're like, oh, we missed it. Do it again.
Imagine how many takes. I actually think it might be the inverse in some instances where the lightning is just going and they're making the choice. And Michael's like, no, we're going with, you know, we've got to find the lightning that best punctuates what we're doing. But
yeah, like Michael will wait for the lightning strike and we will keep doing it till we get it.
We're going to do this 130 times because
he is harnessing the power of God.
He's like the controlling the weather.
Right. He's like, we're going to get this guy. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, to me, it's just like, yeah, it's strange. And it's interesting knowing how long they shot. Like, I worked with the guy who did stunts on Infamous and he was a stunt driver on Miami Vice. And he's like, we spent 3 weeks out on that freeway every night for 3 weeks doing that freeway stuff. So that's a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the amount of time I've shot movies in, you know, and they're just doing that one scene. So he's clearly after this element and this unpredictability and this stuff that is laying on top of a bedrock of authenticity and and sort of and research, and he's combining these two into this aesthetic that has such a level of unpredictability to it, and it just keeps you right on the edge. You know, you're constantly trying to pick up on what they're saying. You're constantly trying to understand it. It requires Michael's work, I think, just requires a very much a lean in quality to what you're watching. It is not a sit back and just have it come at you. You have to really come at it. And if you do, you're rewarded, I think. And if you're not, you tend to not really like it, or you tend to be let down by it, you know, or just disappointed in it, because it's not a spoon fed surface level story. You know, he's really trying to take this stuff and elevate it in a really unique way. And only he really knows what that is going to be.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for scouting Sammy Creek Landing for us. That's where the show is going to be coming from every single week, in a safe house that I'm 100%
show.
I'm 100% sure that Michael Mann actually, it was a safe house in Michael Mann's production company. That's the only way he could have known that location was there.
That is not a location you find unless you are just going and that you find it somehow in a different way.
Yeah.
That's probably a real safe house, like you said.
Yes, exactly.
Look, Josh, thank you so much for being a part of the show. Thanks so much for reaching out. Looking forward to catching Men in the Line, to see your great work and to see what happened beyond harassing Wes Studi about Michael Mann. So it's such a treat to talk to you. It's so amazing to hear how tuned your eyes are to those edits. I mean, I think people are going to get a kick out of listening to you, like just those little fastidious like things that would really annoy a filmmaker who's got an aptitude in directing and editing and all those things. I think it's so
fun. It clearly comes from watching it a lot.
But that's what I mean. Your eyes are tuned to it. You know, Katie and I feel like sometimes because of this, particularly on this movie, we're watching it so much. We're seeing all these little layers. We're seeing these beats, these things that pop up or we ignore, you know, tactfully ignore basically. But it's a treat talking to you, and just look, thank you so much for being a part of the show. I think it's going to be a blast for people to listen to, and I guarantee you people are going to be like, wait, I feel like so many people are going to pause this episode and going to immediately
go back
and watch it. So if that's the joy that we can create for people to go back and keep revisiting this, then it's a thrill. But look, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Yeah, thank man. You. And if you're for those listening to us, it is our time. It is now 3:12 o'clock, and that is the hand that we have been dealt.
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.